You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of May 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
The Iran deal was one of the worst and most one-sided transactions the United States has ever entered into.
There is another circa November 2016, which rivals it for this distinction. My guests Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including Trump's nominee for CIA director facing rigorous questioning about her rigorous questioning, China trying to tell airlines what they can call Taiwan, and Revealed, the city which is able to boast the world's most competent tram drivers. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Goldfarb, the journalist and author, and James Boyes, the historian and author. Welcome both, and we will start with a sentence that, as recently as 2 years ago, would have led reasonable listeners to assume that the presenter had consumed the wrong kind of mushrooms with breakfast. The UK's Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson, has travelled to the United States to appear on Fox News because that's the only way of getting a message to US President Donald Trump. That's actually the world as we now live in it. The message Johnson wishes to impart is that Trump should not drop the US end of the deal between Iran and other parties to limit such nuclear ambitions as Tehran may possess. James, is Boris Johnson's dash onto Fox and Friends going to work?
Well, what's remarkable about this is not necessarily that Boris Johnson is not going to be meeting the president, which should not be expected. He's, after all, only Foreign Secretary. But the fact that so far in the last 2 weeks, we've seen the president of France, the German chancellor in person going over to Washington to lobby President Trump. We're not seeing Theresa May go, but instead her Foreign Secretary, Boris Johnson. And in so doing, attempting to use Fox and Friends, what should be hopefully quite a friendly media reception for him at least, to lobby the president indirectly. That is remarkable, and I think it demonstrates what's become the new normal almost under this president. The idea that if you want to get a message to him, the best way to do it is through this rather awful television show first thing in the morning when he seems to be wide awake and busy tweeting, whilst perhaps he should have been reading policy briefs provided by the CIA, amongst others.
Michael, Boris Johnson, it says here, urged the president not to throw the baby out with the bathwater, was using metaphor wise.
Well, you know, I mean, not just Fox and Friends. Okay, let's be honest. He had a piece in yesterday's New York Times op-ed, and I think he got the name Churchill in the first three words. Not just
when does Boris Johnson not get the word Churchill in the first three words?
But I think he was sliding it in the prez's direction. Like, you could be like Churchill. And I would also add that anything that Boris Johnson says on Fox and Friends, if it's seriously getting through, I think Bibi Netanyahu is going on Israel 24 with another one of his, you know, dog and pony shows about Iran lied. This is the way we talk to the president. Look, how do you argue a policy with someone whose entire ideology is to undo everything that Barack Obama did as president? The soundbite, this is the worst deal. What does that mean? You know that the man has not read the JCPOA, as we call it, the joint. What does it stand for? Joint something memorandum of agreement, and it's known
it's as the joint something plan of action.
Exactly. Joint whatever. JCPOA. And, you know, he hasn't read it. He doesn't know. I honestly don't know. I think that this is very much like in medieval times when embassies were made to the Mad King, and one by one people came in and but nobody knows what he's going to say.
I mean, I for one, would be willing to buy a steak dinner for the first White House reporter just to hold up a globe and ask Donald Trump to point to Iran on it. James, Michael points out that Donald Trump's animus against the Iran deal does seem largely rooted in the fact that it was a deal done by President Barack Obama. Do you have any sense that Trump actually has a plan B in place? If this deal is to fall by the wayside, does he have a better idea?
Well, initially, of course, there was a suggestion that there was no plan B. What we've seen coming out, I think, in the last two or three weeks from European leaders is, well, there has to be a plan B. So a plan B might well be to try to negotiate a secondary deal with the Iranians to go alongside this if, as expected, the Americans try to pull out. But you've got to ask, under what circumstances would the Iranians look at that and negotiate in good faith? Because they'd certainly turn around and say, well, hang on, we negotiated with you in good faith and you're now made in play of the United States has pulled out and reneging upon this deal. So I think the problem you've got with Trump is throughout his presidency, he keeps doing this. As Michael rightly pointed out, he knee-jerks against anything that Obama put in place as though, let's just get rid of it. But when you get rid of it, you have to replace it. So Obamacare being the obvious one, repeal and replace. It's a lovely catchphrase. Well, you can repeal it, but you clearly can't replace it as Republicans and Democrats have proven on the House. So if you just get out of the deal with Iran, that's fine. But what the hell do you replace it with? And let's be frank, this isn't just the Americans who negotiated this. This was the Europeans, it was the Russians, it was the Chinese. And when can you get all those people to agree on anything, quite frankly? So whilst this isn't a perfect deal, it is probably the best bad deal that was available. And if the Iranians are in violation of anything in there, let's hold them to that within the framework of the agreement, because there is a way and a mechanism to do that. But if you pull out of the agreement becomes null and void and you can't hold them to account for anything.
And the other thing is there are other dynamics, power dynamics. I mean, on the Trump side, it really does. I still think it comes from Obama, but people whispering in his ear are, the hard right, the Likud-led Israeli government, and their supporters in the U.S., that 30% of, the American Jewish community that is convinced that Iran is about to drop a nuclear bomb on Israel, which it's not. So there's that dynamic. There's the wider dynamic of Iran in the region. And I think that, today the most Trump's going to do what Trump's going to do. He's trailed very heavily that he's likely to decertify the deal on May 12th. But overnight there were elections in Lebanon. Hezbollah, which is a client of the Iranian regime, won more than 50% of the seats in the Lebanese parliament. Now, this follows the current prime minister of Lebanon, who's not a Shiite, Saad Hariri, being summoned and almost held prisoner in Riyadh about 4 or 5 months ago, saying, you need to know that we, the Saudis, are not happy about the growing strength of Iranian-backed Hezbollah. But Iran doesn't need to back with guns. They've got a lot of people there, and they vote for Hezbollah. Hezbollah has a political power. In Syria, Russia is propping up the Assad regime with the Iranian Revolutionary Guards winning on the battlefield for the Assad regime. Now, if Trump pulls out, is Russia, which, as we said earlier, negotiated, was a key player in negotiating this JCPOA. Is Russia suddenly going to stop being friendly with Iran? No. This will now create a new and deepened alliance, increase that sense that we have of a resumed Cold War with Russia, punching above its weight now. It doesn't have the Soviet Empire behind it. All of that, it's far too dangerous, and it's just so much more than this, I'm going to decertify the agreement.
Okay, well, let's move on slightly, because the well-oiled machine that is the Trump administration may be on the verge of popping another rivet. Trump's nominee to replace new Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as director of the CIA, Gina Haspel, has run into difficulties which may threaten her confirmation by the US Senate. A career CIA officer, Haspel at one point ran a so-called black site in Thailand, that is, an off-the-books detention facility in which suspected jihadis were tortured, or, as Trump blurted on Twitter earlier, was too tough on terrorists for the liking of Democrats. James, it emerged over the weekend that she had already volunteered to withdraw from consideration as director of the CIA. Should she?
Well, I think when you get to a stage where a presidential nominee to be head of any governmental agency, in this case the CIA, is publicly known to have talked about withdrawing, it's very difficult to see how that is going to progress, quite frankly, because, of course, what you're asking members of the Senate to do is to put their necks out to vote for this individual when it seems that she herself realizes the writing is up on the wall. The White House, I think, has been somewhat ambiguous with regards to this, just as they became with regards to their Secretary for the Veterans Affairs Administration to take over that role at one point. They came very close to losing Mike Pompeo out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. So at this point, they could be batting one for three, which obviously is very poor average at this level. This is the problem when you have a nomination process which has seriously not vetted these people correctly in many, many ways. And the idea of putting your physician forward to run the VA is just, you couldn't make this up, but this is Trump's presidency. So the idea of putting this woman forward to run the CIA, I think, has been done really without any kind of forethought. And it's asking a great deal of Donald Trump's fellow Republicans in Congress, in the Senate, to basically get behind this when it seems as though she herself sees the writing on the wall.
Michael, how tight a squeeze might confirmation be? And would the Senate really dare to stymie a nomination for a fairly important job? But the Senate, even if it splits on party lines, it's 51 Republicans against 49 Democrats or independents. And John McCain, of course, is probably unable to attend.
Right. Well, you know, one of the trends, if one pays close attention from the other side of the ocean and not, you know, retailing the dinner table gossip of the Beltway, is that in the end, the Republicans always come into line behind Trump over and over again. You know, we were talking earlier about the Mike Pompeo nomination to replace Rex Tillerson. Oh, it's not going to get out of committee. It got, you know, John McCain, Lindsey, what's his name?
Graham,
yeah. The two amigos, you know, with the conscience of the Republican Party, all over the Washington Post. Well, I don't know, Politico, we don't know, I'm not sure. Of course they voted. If the president wants it, the president gets it. And I think that to a considerable degree, that's likely to happen here, partially because of what you were just saying. One out of three, James, it's a bad batting average. Yeah. And even though the nominee to head the VA is... head of VA is not an important position in comparison to running the CIA. The other thing, of course, is that we don't know really what the agency thinks of this. Now, we know that this woman was involved in running a black site in Thailand, and she's clearly a careerist. She followed orders from Washington. But I do think that there's an element within the CIA that says, well, look, you know, she is taking one for the team by all of this being made public. At some way, she's been a career officer in the field. She's worked undercover. She's one of us. And actually, they may think it's not a bad appointment. Anyway, it's a long-winded way of saying I think she quite possibly will be appointed and will have forgotten about how close yet again a Trump decision came to blowing up in his face.
James, she now says that she would oppose the reintroduction of enhanced interrogation, which was the 2001 era euphemism for torturing prisoners. Donald Trump has been quite keen on the idea. It's unclear as ever with Trump that he actually knows what he's talking about, but this has been a repeated theme of many of his speeches, that not only is he in favor of waterboarding, he's in favor of going beyond that.
Yeah, I think sometimes we have to be careful in terms of understanding exactly how many cases of waterboarding there actually were in terms of that tenure. But certainly the idea that we've got someone who is likely to be run, is, you know, become DCI. And that's not, of course, just heading up the CIA that's, you know, responsible for the wider US intelligence operations. But the idea that she could be forced to take orders from Donald Trump to roll back those ideas that those should no longer be implemented becomes increasingly problematic. You've got to ask under what circumstances Donald Trump would in any way authorize such use of such enhanced interrogations, considering the era we're in. I mean, back then in the post 9/11 era, there was obviously a focus against which that would be implemented. But for all of Donald Trump's bluster, and I think he is the ultimate bully, quite frankly, when it comes to this kind of thing. So I think he's very, very good at talking the talk, but very bad at walking the walk. It's difficult to understand exactly who he would suggest that be implemented against. And of course, with the oversight coming in from the Senate, as well as a fresh, I think, appreciation of the indiscretions that the United States has engaged in since the attacks of 2001, I think it would be difficult to see under which auspices that would be implemented.
Michael, if the following question for Gina Haspel has occurred to me, I'm sure and I indeed hope it would have occurred to at least one of the Democratic senators about to question her, but does she have an answer if someone asks her, does enhanced interrogation or torture work, and if necessary, would you do it again?
Does she have an answer?
Yeah.
Yes. She would say yes. Mm-hmm. I'm certain, but not in a really definitive way. And she would. That's my guess. I mean, if you've done it, and she, I don't know, she was in the room when it was done. In some cases, I believe. But if you have implemented that, then she would say yes, it works. I mean, this is one of the things we can never know because it's all kept classified. The other thing, of course, is what is the purpose of enhanced interrogation? What is the purpose of torture? And on this, I know a bit because I've done quite a bit of reporting about torture. And that is, it's never about the information you get. It's about punishment and letting people in the networks of the people you've arrested know that this is what will happen to you. It gets back to people. And I think that
it
in
is,
that respect,
as Orwell said, the point of torture is torture.
Exactly right. I mean, you get, you know, any halfway decent terrorist organization, and Al-Qaeda was certainly a well-organized one, it knows that, you know, if somebody gets detained, then the cell of which they were part is immediately broken apart because those names will be coming out very, very quickly. But the reason you torture people is to punish them. And you hope that the word of the brutality gets out so that the people who might be sympathetic with them might consider their actions before they become terrorists.
James, we've seen Donald Trump's Midas touch in operation several times since he was sworn in sort of his various preferences for cabinet, his picks in various Senate and House races. He has shown considerable alacrity in throwing people under the bus if he feels that the mood has shifted irrecoverably against them. Is it possible that we might see that happen again?
Well, what he has a tendency to do is to, again, we saw this with regards to the nominee to run the Veterans Affairs Administration, the suggestion that he will hold a press conference and he will offer his sort of wholehearted support to a point, suggests that this is all very, very unfair, that the media are asking the wrong questions, that the Democrats are being obstructionist and just getting in the way, and that what the CIA had done previously was all about protecting the homeland, that it was all about preventing attacks before they occurred, and that he thinks it's terribly unfair, but he would understand why the person would withdraw. And as soon as you come out with that line, that's like starting to pull the carpet out. Because at that point, it's like, hedge.
It was so weird because Friday she apparently said, I'm willing to step down.
Yeah.
And then they sent Sarah Sanders, the famous smoky-eyed Sarah Sanders, out to see her at CIA.
Absolutely.
And she said, well, actually, no, I don't think I will withdraw my name. Yeah. And it was like, I get the sense that it was the White House that was bucking her up.
Yeah. You know, saying, it's all very, very strange. You know.
Okay, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes. Coming up next, why China is sending angry emails to the world's airlines.
Monocle's May issue invites you to hang out with the world's brightest-eyed, bushiest-tailed new world leader. Jacinda Ardern is New Zealand's Prime Minister on a mission to turn her lively first 100 days in office into years of growth and good vibrations. Talking of which, we switch to California, dreaming of a modernist Mecca under cloudless skies, happy people in lovely homes. We're moving to LA, incidentally. Elsewhere, let us show you fauna. Dogs like this guy, coughing cartoons like these, porcelain pets, pussies, pilchards. We also suspend our disbelief with a visit to the studio of the artist and the set designer Ez Devlin, who's done big things for Adele and Beyoncé. We take five with jazz saviour Kamasi Washington, we sit pretty and count down our 50 favourite design innovations and marvel at Belgrade's Palace of Serbia and its marble rigour and surreal spotlessness. It's always a good time for a glass of something fortifying, of course, and so we have a vino with Adam Gopnik, hello Adam, a flirtini in Yokohama, and finish the bottle with these kiwis. And we're back to New Zealand then. Why are these suitcases smiling? Well, now you know why. Monocle's May issue is out now. Get your copy today or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're back with Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Goldfarb and James Boyes. Now, if this White House accuses you of having perpetrated Orwellian nonsense, the time has surely come for a long, hard look at oneself. Such introspection seems unlikely from China, which stands so accused, although, given the literary nature of the charge, probably not by President Trump directly. China has written to dozens of foreign airlines insisting that they desist from any reference to Taiwan as a country or Hong Kong and Macau as anything but indivisible parts of the People's Republic. Michael, loath though I am to agree with this White House, it strikes me that their response in this instance is pretty much the correct one, isn't it?
Well, you know, I'm wondering about the origins of this controversy. You know, I believe that the United States is trying to provoke a trade war with the Chinese, and I just wonder if this comes...
I'd forgotten about the trade war. That seems like very much like last month's thing.
Yeah, I know. Well, you see, we just put the three... I don't know if people listening understand the throughput that goes through your brain, Andrew, during the course of a week of presenting all these programs on Monocle. The number of stories you have to really be expert in, mm-hmm. and then you have to just push them right out the side door to get the next set in. I knew we were going to talk about this, and I immediately said, this doesn't sound right to me because relations between the People's Republic and Taiwan, for example, have been sort of okay for a while. And I checked this out. Nearly $200 billion a year in trade between the PRC and Taiwan. 30% of Taiwanese exports go back into the PRC. So I'm wondering if this is more to gin up some headlines to American Airlines. Delta was in the frame on this.
Well, Delta has apologized to China in the face of Chinese fury about such things. So have a few other companies, among them Zara and Marriott. James, is that the smart thing to do from a corporate perspective, apologizing? I understand that the gesture you're making there, and just to be clear to listeners,
it was
the one about money. But is there any chance of, should they factor in some sort of domestic backlash if they are seen by their American customers as having kowtowed?
Interesting phraseology. One wonders the extent to which American domestic considerations are going to play a large part with regard to airliners and wonders how many are actually flying into China with regards to that. I do think if we flip this around, let's just think about this. With the exception of Taiwan, there's a lot of talk here about Hong Kong and Macau. Do the Chinese have a point? Because, of course, Hong Kong reverted back to Chinese rule in the late 1990s,
indeed.
97 and
99,
if I'm not mistaken. That's getting on for, 20-odd years now. They are factually correct to suggest that these are part of China now, if we're not mistaken.
Are they really suggesting they're not?
Well, I don't know. But if they are trying to suggest that there is any suggestion that these now are not part of Chinese domain, then they do have a point. But the question here is this really worth the sort of the focus of the White House or even the Chinese state? Because when you think about it, there's an interesting dilemma here because the president, President Trump, is constantly talking about his great relationship with the Chinese leader, President Xi. Which is great. But then at the sub-leaders level, there seems to be this antagonism between the nations at a trade war level, which Donald Trump, of course, has already said, well, the Americans have lost the trade war. And now we're just trying to chip back and chip back and chip back. But there does seem to be this very odd two-track game going on here between the White House and Beijing, which is very, very difficult to read in terms of where the overall focus is, I think.
Michael, is this briefly just part of China's general plan of just chewing away at any suggestion of Taiwanese sovereignty wherever it finds it? I mean, this is the reason that Taiwan can't compete in Olympic Games as Taiwan and so on.
Yeah, you know, I mean, and going back to one of the earliest controversies of the Trump era was, you know, he called the president of Taiwan, you know, and we're on your side. It was like 1956 Republican Party stuff, you know, and I just think it's something that they can always, it's a switch they can always flip and get a headline and get people talking about in a studio.
Okay, well, finally tonight, congratulations to Stockholm, whose tram drivers are the best in Europe, if not the world. This, at least, is the upshot of this year's European Tram Driver Championships, held this past weekend in Stuttgart. Team Stockholm outpointed their rivals in various disciplines, testing spatial awareness, judgment of distances, braking technique, and ability to knock down inflatable pins by using a tram to hit a large bowling ball at them. I didn't know about the European Tram Driver Championships. I'm thinking of going next year. It sounds like absolutely excellent fun, though I'm disappointed there's not an actual race.
But I mean, they're on tracks, man.
I know, but that's what I think. If you had like two lots of parallel tracks lined up against each other and just sort of, the test would be, it's like, you know, how fast can you take those corners without putting the thing on its side?
I would
watch the hell out of that. The reason that we wanted to insert this item into today's program was to ask you both if there were any public transport operatives anywhere in the world that either of you think either deserve awards just for doing their job or might benefit from this sort of competition.
I think, quite frankly, any cab driver looking to get anybody out to either JFK Airport in New York or to Dulles International outside Washington, D.C. deserves a prize in some cases just for the longevity of the journey, quite frankly, because neither city make trying to get out to those two vital hubs into the United States easy for cab drivers or for anybody who's looking at making the haul.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, I drove a cab in New York City in the 1970s for 3 years. It was my rent maker while I was trying to be something else. And you can't do that anymore. I would say you can't have a race. It used to be that I could make it to Kennedy in 45 minutes from Midtown.
I was saying, a race by New York City cab drivers, I wouldn't sit too close to the fence.
Yeah, no, exactly. However, one of the fun things is, you know, the lights are, because it's a grid in Manhattan, and the lights are timed, and they used to, I don't think they do anymore, switch to yellow, flashing yellow after midnight. And I used to try, along with, especially on Monday night when business is slow, you get about five guys trying to go downtown past Lincoln Center on I guess it's 10th Avenue. And you could get from about 66th Street to 34th Street, which is a bit more than a mile, without hitting a light. And, you know, it was a good competition. I mean, it was sort of like NASCAR, because all of these big eight-cylinder Dodges and Checkers that we were driving, you know, it was sort of like NASCAR. And you know, people would wave at us, but once you got going, nobody was interested in the fare anymore. Yeah. It was mostly about who could get to 34th Street first.
I mean, there are or have been, certainly, I think they still do them after a fashion, races of Sydney Harbour ferries. I have a vague recollection that one sank one year, mercifully, it had reached the dock at Circular Quay before it sank. I think that put them off for a while. But I don't know how serious they are. James, are there any public transport operatives anywhere that you think deserve special recognition, apart from Michael's colleagues behind yellow cabs in New York?
Well, it's difficult, because I think I was going to nominate cab drivers here in London, because obviously there was that situation where, of course, black cab drivers were renowned for having to memorize the streets and take exams.
The
knowledge base, which is a wonderful thing. Let's give our hats to that. But we're now in an era of like Waze and Google Maps, for example, where, quite frankly, anybody has got that knowledge at their fingertips. And I think it's a sign of a past era almost. And one wonders, when you're in the back of a cab sometimes, why it is that these people aren't using these sat-nav situations, because because the amount of times I've had the good fortune to be driven in to do various media interviews and of taking my life in my hands in the process has been rather scary on occasion.
Well, that does bring us to the end of today's show. James Boyes and Michael Goldfarb, thank you for joining us at Midori House. Today's show was produced by Marcus Hippie, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tom Melville. The studio manager was David Stevens. Music next at 1900. It's the Monocle Culture Show with Rob Bound. I'm back with more on the day's main stories on the Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at 1800 tomorrow. I'm Andrew Millip. Thank you for listening.